The original pathology head of the NSABP was Dr. Edwin Fisher, brother of Bernie Fisher, who worked hand-in-hand with his sibling for years, not only to change the treatment of breast cancer, but also the contribution of breast pathology. Dr. Soon Paik has nobly followed this tradition of excellence and moved the NSABP into the era of molecular pathology, with particular emphasis on predictors of response to systemic therapy. Every interview with Dr. Paik is a content roller coaster ride, and he began this chat by discussing his fascinating work on predictors of relapse in patients with HER2-positive disease who receive adjuvant trastuzumab.
What we are interested in is to see whether we can identify either prognostic factors or predictive markers for benefit from trastuzumab, because we, although they had a significant benefit, still their four-year recurrence rate was about 15%, so they were not completely cured. So we had to have a next-generation trial where we add more agent like bevacizumab, but we didn't want to give it to everybody, so we had to generate a prognostic model for Herceptin-treated patients. So there we were trying to do many markers.
So what specific markers are you looking at?
Right, so there are obvious candidates such as HER2 gene copy or expression level by immunohistochemistry, as well as some other molecules that are described as important in a HER2 receptor signaling pathway, such as P10. So we have looked at that.
So I know one of the things you've looked at that's been very revealing has been c-MYC, and I want to ask you about that. But can you talk about the other things that you looked at? I'm curious about the gene copy. What have you found there?
Oh, yeah. So and obviously, that's actually very interesting biology, because since trastuzumab is a targeted therapy to HER2, in theory, one would expect that HER2 level should be a direct predictor of degree of benefit from trastuzumab in adjuvant setting. But when you looked at it, and it's by gene amplification level, it did not. So it turns out that because of the way that the eligibility was set up in B31 trial, about 10% of the patient overall turned out to have a normal copy, no amplification.
Did everybody have FISH?
In the end, we did FISH on everybody by central assay, and it turns out that 10% of them was normal copy, no amplification. Now, some of them have still some overexpression of the protein, and obviously these are highly selected patients because originally they were tested positive by immunohistochemistry or FISH, so it's not entirely completely negative patient. At least by central assay, these are HER2 negative patients by definition.
And so these patients were IHC 3+ in a central lab and then got into the study and found to be FISH negative?
No, the way that we conducted it is initially any lab could do the testing, and if they were either 3+ immunostaining by any immunohistochemical assay or FISH amplified, then they were eligible. And then we published this data that we found 20% false positive rate when you did central testing. So we changed our eligibility. Still, we allowed so-called qualified labs to perform the assay. So there were about 23 labs that were performing HER2 assay. So when we combined this initial accrual with fairly bad assays and later relatively good assays, which greatly improved the situation, but still, overall, we had 10% patients who were tested negative by central assay.
So did every patient in the study have central IHC in FISH?
Yes.
So in other words, these were 10% of the patients were essentially HER2 negative.
Right. Actually, probably about 7% are HER2 negative, because among those FISH negative patients, some of them are immunohistochemistry positive.
Right.
Still.
So were there enough patients or events to document whether there was any impact of Herceptin in the HER2 negative patients?
Yeah, we actually have only 10%, so it's fairly
enough,
small
right.
number, but actually in those small number of patients with an absolutely normal copy HER2, equal or below 2 copies per cell, there actually is a trend to benefit. So that's quite surprising. And when you do the interaction test or test for heterogeneity of benefit, impact of benefit across all categories of gene amplification, we didn't find any significance. So It tells me that looks like the HER2-gene copy number is not going to be a good predictor of degree of benefit. So new guideline adapted by ASCO and CAP states that if the ratio is between 1.8 to 2.2, they will be essentially regarded as kind of equivocal cases, and they should be tested again or backed up by immunohistochemistry data. It essentially recommends very strict quality control for the labs that conducts testing for the HER2.
Does it sort of come down to volume, or is it sort of beyond that?
Beyond that, a volume plus actually a demonstration of the concordance between immunohistochemistry and FISH.
Any guess about what fraction of breast cancer patients are getting HER2 done correctly in this country?
I think the situation has improved since we published that paper at JNCI, and there has been a lot of effort by CAP and ASCO and NCCN to improve the situation. There has been a worldwide effort to improve the quality of the HER2 assays. Overall, I think it's gotten much better.
Do you think the situation with ER is any better than HER2?
No, ER is, I think, much worse.
Worse.
Right. The next target will be definitely ER assay standardization. But the problem there is that for HER2, we had two competing assays that we could always compare with. And besides, the expression level of HER2 is a little bit of bimodal distribution because of amplification. Now, the ER is not like that. It's more continuous. So because of the fact that the current generation of immunohistochemical assay that pathology labs use, utilize amplification method for the signal to generate a color in the slide that bias the assay to too sensitive at the low level of estrogen receptor. So it's going to be a fairly difficult effort.
You know, when I look at this issue of HER2 and ER testing, it's really disturbing.
Right.
I don't see why people are not more upset about ER.
Oh, yeah, actually, that's... I think it's mainly because people believe that there is more false positives than false negatives in ER assay, and therefore, you know, giving tamoxifen is not going to do much harm.
Is that the case, though?
Which is not the case,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of false negatives.
Yeah, there are also false negative cases. Also, I think if you look at B14 data that we presented at the ASCO last year, I think, that if you look at the RNA-based ER assay, there is a linear relationship between the amount of estrogen receptor RNA and degree of benefit from tamoxifen in B14 trial that compared placebo versus tamoxifen in ER, so-called ER-positive tumors. And if you look at estrogen receptor in the same trial, estrogen receptor was absolutely nonlinear. So by immunohistochemistry, was absolutely nonlinear. So that's why I think that it will be fairly difficult to optimize using the current generation assay. We simply have to develop a new assay for estrogen receptor.
What was the assay that was looked at the recent B14?
B14 actually is a part of the Oncotype assay.
That's interesting. So was it the Genomic Health Oncotype assay?
Right.
So they pulled out the ER part of that?
Yeah, just the ER and looked at it in B14 as a predictor of tamoxifen benefit. It turns out that it was a very strong predictor.
Interesting. Getting back to HER2 and trastuzumab, can you talk about the work that you did with c-MYC, what it is and what you found?
Yeah, so the reason that we looked at the c-MYC was because c-MYC actually, we had any clue about what c-MYC does in a HER2 pathway, but because in a kind of a global screening of amplified genes in breast cancer in another trial called B28, which is a purely chemotherapy trial in node-positive patients, we looked at 27 different amplified genes based on array comparative genomic hybridization data.
And again, who did the assay?
We did the assay. But essentially what it did was to look at the literature from comparative genomic hybridization, compare that with expression array data to find candidate genes that, when they are amplified, had a high expression of the genes. So we pulled out 27 of them and developed a FISH probes for those and then screened them in a clinical cohort of 1,900 patients in B28.
And that was all AC and Taxotere, essentially, right? With or without Taxotere.
Right.
And what did you see there?
So what we found was that there were seven genes or amplified genes that were prognostic in chemotherapy-treated patients. And when we did multivariate analysis with including all the other clinical variables, we found that there were three genes that remained significant or marginally significant that included HER2, c-MYC, and another gene in AP called HDP-AP.
What about ER?
ER was not significant. Right. In that trial, it was not significant.
That's a whole other story, I guess.
Right, yeah, that's a whole other story.
So then you looked at c-MYC in the Herceptin study.
Right. So original hypothesis was a very naive one, that c-MYC obviously is a prognostic factor, and should not really influence Herceptin response per se. So we thought that we're going to have a prognostic factor. So even after Herceptin treatment, if c-MYC is amplified, patients will still have poor prognosis, so they may be a candidate to give bevacizumab. The result was completely reversed, that it is actually c-MYC amplified patient, which is about one-third of the population, HER2-positive population, that derived the maximum benefit from trastuzumab. And in fact, if you look at survival outcome, there seems to be almost no benefit in c-MYC non-amplified patient.
How about relapse rate?
Relapse rate, there was still benefit in the c-MYC non-amplified patient, but it was much more attenuated. So that if you look at the interaction between c-MYC and degree of benefit from trastuzumab, is extremely strong p-value.
Hmm.
So I wondered why c-MYC turns out to be the predictor. And it actually turns out that I was fairly, unknowledgeable about c-MYC biology. It's actually amazing that my late friend Bob Dixon at Georgetown has been working on c-MYC forever, and he's been begging me to look at c-MYC for the past 15 years, and I always kind of ignored him, saying, oh, c-MYC is just a prognostic factor, why look at it? As soon as I got the result, I was shocked. So then I began to read the literature about c-MYC, and it turns out that it makes a lot of sense, that the c-MYC is a transcriptional factor, and it regulates essentially a lot of genes, including cell proliferation, but also cell death. So it's kind of crazy that the same molecule regulates both cell proliferation and cell death. It turns out that it's almost like an inherent biological defense of the cells to have against cancer. So the genes that are important in the body are always dual regulators, many of these genes. So the c-MYC is one of them, actually. By having this dual capability of inducing both proliferation and cell death, when this molecule becomes abnormal, so deregulated expression due to gene amplification or mutation or whatever, then the cells will go through cell death, so they cannot become cancer cells. So the only way that they can actually become cancer cells is when they get help from survival factors that inhibits apoptotic signal.
Like what?
So my theory is that HER2 is the one of them. So in those cells that has gene amplification of both HER2 and c-MYC, which is actually a very small subset of breast cancer, it's about 6% of total breast cancer, the HER2 is not the oncogene there. c-MYC is the oncogene. What HER2 does is HER2 helps c-MYC to become the oncogene by suppressing cell death signal. So in that setting, because of the high survival signal coming from HER2, the cells are inherently resistant to chemotherapy because there's a strong survival signal there.
So chemotherapy is part of the equation here too.
Right. So if you give Herceptin, that trastuzumab there, then what will happen is that that survival signal goes away. Then this strong c-MYC will induce cell death, especially with combination with chemotherapy, will cause a massive cell suicide.
That's interesting. It's always been this question about how much of the effect of trastuzumab is synergy with chemotherapy as opposed, we know as a single agent it has significant activity. Does your model make sense in terms of the effect of Herceptin without chemo?
So there are two possibilities to interpret this data. One is that the Herceptin obviously has immune-related cell death too. So the reason that c-MYC negative patients also gain some benefit from disease-free survival might be due to the fact that there is immune killing on top of the chemotherapy killing. The other possibility is that what Herceptin does in that setting is simple growth inhibition, not cell death. That's why, actually, if you look at the Kaplan-Meier plot in that setting, you have a continued failure, even under Herceptin. Whereas if you look at c-MYC amplified cohort, there's almost no failure after 2 years. So that tells me that the c-MYC amplified patient, the mechanism of Herceptin there is mainly with chemotherapy, cell kills. There's actual apoptosis going on. Whereas in the c-MYC negative patient, what Herceptin does is simple growth inhibition. So that hypothesis then predicts that for c-MYC positive patient, maybe you don't need to give Herceptin for 1 year. You just need to give it together with chemo. Whereas in c-MYC negative patient, you have to give it forever, essentially.
Has anyone else looked at c-MYC and trastuzumab?
I think there is a plan to look at it in the intergroup study as well as in the HERA study, but
how about the BCRG?
BCRG, I think eventually we'll look at
so
it.
So no hopefully. One's looked at it yet?
Not yet.
Do you think that these data are solid enough that the next study actually would incorporate it into it?
We are trying to, in the next trial design for the NSABP trial for Herceptin, trastuzumab with bevacizumab, but it's still in the air. We are still waiting for the validation from intergroup study to happen.
Is there any way that this could be accelerated? And I guess I'm wondering specifically about the neoadjuvant setting. I know I've been talking to some of the clinicians in the NSABP, and I've heard that now there's discussion about trying to get a neoadjuvant study up and running for HER2 positive. Do you think that that's a setting where maybe you could get some answers quicker?
I think it's because possibility, but because the c-MYC amplification is only in 30% of HER2-amplified patients, so the sample size is an issue.
Any guesses about in the c-MYC-negative patients what would work, i.e., the things obviously that are being talked about right now are lapatinib and bevacizumab. Any guess as to which one of those strategies might make more sense in c-MYC-negative patients?
That's a very difficult, tough question. There is both possibilities. So lapatinib, if you look at in vitro cell response, HER2-positive cells response to the drug in vitro, Herceptin doesn't induce apoptosis very well, whereas lapatinib does very, very well.
So what's the implication
in terms? So the implication is that Herceptin, especially in the c-MYC negative patient, might be simply causing G1 arrest, not apoptosis, whereas lapatinib might actually readily induce apoptosis, not dependent on c-MYC.
In those c-MYC negative patients, to you, does it make more sense to use both trastuzumab and lapatinib or just lapatinib?
That I don't know. It probably makes sense to add them both because there is still disease-free survival benefit with trastuzumab alone.
Let's talk a little bit about Oncotype DX. Can you kind of update us on where that is right now?
I think that probably there has been two interesting issues that came out, was raised by many people for Oncotype assay. Because our data shows that if patient has a HER2 amplification, then they are usually high or intermediate risk, and none of them are low risk. Now, Steve Schack tells me that in their series of like 10,000 patients they screened so far, they actually find some patients that are HER2 amplified but still has low risk. So he thinks that they still have to be tested, but my bias, looking at B14 data, is that they don't really need to be tested. Now, because of that data, there has been some people arguing that if you take out HER2, a positive amplified patient, then Oncotype assay will not be as strong a prognosticator for the HER2-negative patient. So we did look at HER2-negative subset in B14, and actually it worked exactly as the overall cohort.
With Oncotype?
Right. So
have you presented that?
No, we never presented it. We just got the data. So
getting back, this issue of the fact that there are tumors out there that are HER2 positive but low recurrence score, but do we know anything about the prognosis of those?
Oh, I have no idea because that's outside our study.
Right.
Probably there's no follow-up information.
So that's one issue.
The other issue is that I think everybody wants to find out whether Oncotype assay can be used in node-positive patients. And there, I think we are eagerly waiting for essentially Cathy Albin SWOG study to see whether it will be also predictive of chemo response in node-positive patients.
Can you talk to us a little bit about where the project with Genomic Health and colon cancer is right now and how that compares to where you are in breast cancer?
Right. So in colon cancer, we are actually taking much more careful steps because I guess we learned by mistake, making mistakes in breast cancer. So instead of coming out with a product with only two-step validation, like we did in Oncotype assay, and ended up having Taylor X trial, what we are doing with colon cancer studies, multi-step development of the assay so that instead of going through model development and then validation immediately, we are actually going through lot more genes, 780 genes initially, instead of 250 genes in breast cancer. And then we are looking at kind of an initial kind of a gene discovery set, and then after that we are looking at gene refinement step, and then model building and model refinement step, and then final validation. So it's a long way to go, but the exciting thing is that it's happening. So
how long?
I guess about 2 years.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
Yeah, when you do it, it's pretty fast. It's just that the design is fairly complex.
So you're kind of trying to avoid having a big bunch of people where you don't really know, which was what happened in breast cancer with the intermediate. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's more, I think what we see in breast cancer with Oncotype assay is a biological truth, I truly believe, so that you cannot avoid the presence of intermediate group because it's a continuous biology. I think the clinicians always have a kind of a tendency to prefer dichotomous variables, but the actual biology should be linear.
So do you think it makes sense to do the Taylor trial?
Taylor trial, my personal feeling has always been that the Taylor trial will be very difficult to accrue, mainly because once the patient has the score, maybe it'll be very difficult to convince them to be randomized. It's a high-risk project, and on top of that, to get the result, it'll take 10 years. And in that period, probably there will be better assays developed that surpass the Oncotype assay. So it's a philosophical differences in how you develop and validate the marker and when you think it's ready for prime time. And we think that with enough retrospective data, it's ready for prime time. And the other clinicians believe that they need a real prospectively designed study with a modern patient, modern regimens to validate the result before becoming a prime time.
You know, one of the things that has a lot of people excited about Oncotype DX is the idea of, quote, getting a more accurate ER in HER2.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that methodology is where we're going to be heading, at least in terms of those two markers?
I think so. Maybe not necessarily Oncotype assay only,
right?
Because Oncotype assay is just one variation of the methodologies for looking at RNA. Certainly, we are working with Genomic Health and others to develop the accurate cutoff for ER and HER2 so that those assay values will be reported separately from Oncotype assay, other genes, so that you will have ER value and HER2 value.
How long do you think it'll be before that happens?
Oh, maybe 6 months to a year.
Will that be valid or will that make sense, for example, for a node-positive tumor?
Yeah, I don't think it really matters.
What about ER-negative? So it's really just a method to do HER2 and ER?
Right, right.
Huh.
Yeah.
You know, for clinicians who are not in the middle of all this, and you see all these genomic things at ASCO, so many different companies and groups. Is there any way to sort out, you know, what's going on right now? Why is Genomic Health different, if at all, than all these other groups? And sort of where do you think we're going to be in the next 5 years or 10 years with all this?
I think the best way to understand it is looking at Chuck Perrow's paper in New England Journal that published recently that essentially compares the 70-gene assay and the Chuck Perrow intrinsic subtypes versus recurrent score, Oncotype assay versus two-gene score from Arcturus, and essentially show that excluding the two-gene score, all the others essentially behaved very similarly. And essentially what it is that we are looking at the biology of breast cancer. I think we are looking for two things. One is estrogen receptor signature, strong estrogen receptor pathway, which is not perfectly captured by ER assay that we are using, and the proliferation, which we don't have a good assay for it now. So essentially all these signatures does, including Oncotype assay, my belief is that they are like a boutique assay for ERM proliferation. Now, the difference between these other 70-gene assay or other assays and Oncotype assay is that from a fundamental development philosophy point of view, they wanted to develop a dichotomous assay based on these gene values, whereas we wanted to develop continuous predictor.
I want to ask you about the correlative tissue studies that are going to be done with the neoadjuvant B40 study, mm-hmm. the HER2-negative study.
Right.
Taxotere alone, has three mm-hmm. different kinds of chemo with capecitabine or gemcitabine, plus or minus bevacizumab.
Right.
What are some of the tissue studies right now that are being planned for that?
So obviously, a lot of the excitement reason that the field is kind of hooked on to neoadjuvant setting is because we think that we can use pre-treatment biopsy samples to do gene expression array or other studies to then correlate with the PCR, a complete pathological response, to identify predictive genes. But if you look at the performance of gene expression correlation with PCR in published studies so far, I think the best example is the one published by Hess et al. From MD Anderson, recently in JCO. That shows that although you can reasonably predict PCR with gene expression signature to the degree that if it is predicted to be non-responders, nobody responded. But the problem is that if you predict to be as a responder, only half of them responded. So,
and that goes back to the old in vitro studies,
right.
Which is the same thing.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
I think it is possible that the chemotherapy response is not as specific as we think, is that the chemotherapy that we routinely use currently are not really very specific toxins targeted on single target. They are fairly general toxins, unfortunately. And I think the cells have fairly limited way of responding to general toxins. And there will be the subtypes of cancers that have different pathways that they have. For example, CMYK-positive tumors will have a very different response to chemotherapy compared to CMYK-negative tumors, as I described before.
Right.
Or those tumors with strong anti-apoptotic signal, for example, will have different response. So it is possible that subset of the tumors might have a more specific response to chemo, different chemo, but in general, I think what we are seeing is more like a general response. So it's going to be fairly difficult to predict with pinpoint accuracy whether a given tumor will respond to a specific regimen.
What about bevacizumab?
Bevacizumab, I think, again, it's a targeted therapy. The hope is that if you have a accurate measurement of its targets, we might have a good predictor. So far, I don't think we have used a accurate measurement.
Really?
Right.
So you think there's been a problem in terms of the methodology?
Right. So
really?
I think if you look at, for example, RNA level of VEGF, for example, or other molecules involved in that pathway, we might have actually a fairly good predictor.
In the tumor?
In the tumor, right.
Any guess as to whether the primary target of this is going to be in the tumor or in the stroma?
We don't know, but my guess is that if we actually look at the average signal, we probably will have enough.
In the tumor?
Right, right. No, I mean, what I'm saying is that grind up tumor that includes everything.
Right, yeah. Right.
But it's a matter of testing. We will test it. We have been doing a lot of microarrays on neoadjuvant setting, B27
right.
samples, and we believe that we can get the genes that are fairly predictive of chemotherapy response, but not 100%, like in MD Anderson studies. So we think that it has to be complemented by actual physical measurement of response. So that's why we actually, in B40, we are also combining in vitro chemosensitivity assay.
What assay is it?
We collaborate with a company called Precision Therapeutics that does in vitro chemosensitivity assay. So you grow the tumor cells in vitro and give chemotherapy and look at the response. The only difference between other existing in vitro chemosensitivity assay and the Precision Therapeutics assay is that they actually provide dose response curve so that we will be able to look at the phenomenon in a much more linear fashion.
So the agents that are being looked at in B40 are docetaxel, gemcitabine, and capecitabine.
Right.
So those are the three that are going to be studied?
Right, as well as some other drugs.
We were talking before about ER mm-hmm. and in the B28 trial. What do you think about all the controversy about the impact of chemotherapy based on ER. What's that all about?
Yeah, the ER, I think, is fairly predictive.
Is that just a surrogate for proliferation, do you think?
No, I think the ER-positive tumors are inherently, they have a good anti-apoptotic machinery. Because ER essentially is a blocker for apoptosis. So, you know, when on menopause, there is a massive suicide of the gland cells in the breast. What happens is that because of estrogen withdrawal, they go through massive suicide. Because the estrogen is a survival factor, very strong survival factor for these cells.
But what's that got to do with chemotherapy?
So those cells that has strong ER pathway have a strong survival signal. So they're not going to readily die with chemotherapy.
Well, but, you know, a lot of tumors and patients with ER-positive tumors don't respond to hormones.
I know, right. No, the problem is that the ER assay that we have gives a lot of false positive results. That's the bottom line.
That's interesting.
If you actually compare microarray data or Oncotype DX data, so if you actually do the microarray in B27, because I have clinical ER assay that we did centrally, by immunohistochemistry, and then do microarray data for the whole or the Oncotype assay genes, 16 genes, then what Oncotype assay does is it identifies tumors with very high level of expression of all ER genes, ER, BCL. There are a lot of genes that express coordinately with ER itself, so ER, BCL2, the gene called SCOBY2, GATA3. Those are like a typical markers of functioning ER pathway. Those never show PCR. It's not likely that they will benefit much from chemotherapy. And that's what's essentially what Oncotype assay does, identify these low-risk patients that are high ER. But not just high ER, but high functioning ER.
Every time I meet with you, I think that I'm like back in college and meeting with my professor in a course that I'm failing.
I'm learning as I go, essentially, because every day we have different, you know, new data. But obviously, it's trial and error. And by looking at it, sometimes you get wrong conclusions. So it has to be validated. I think the problem is that the way that the field was heading was based on in vitro studies and hypotheses and essentially almost like ground up.
Right.
Whereas I think the approach that I thought is more valuable when I left academic to come to the clinical trial was I did all that long time. I did a lot of in vitro models, transfections and all that. It never gave me anything valuable. That's why I decided to look at bottoms down. So look at, without bias, look at the clinical data and identify what's meaningful and then work on it.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.